CKUW 95.9 FM, homegrown in Winnipeg.
The following is an encore presentation from CKUW's archives.
Good morning, folks. Good Friday morning. If it is Friday, and if it is 11 a.m., and you're listening to CKUW, you're listening to the Hope Alley of No Fixed Address show, and we talk about the social injustices in the world and defend and try to talk about the issues that plague the vulnerable in our society, who, and for those who cannot speak for themselves. The temperature outside today is 16, cloudy, windy. It's kind of drizzly, kind of not. I think it's going to be an uncomfortable day for the folks that are living out there. So as we say each and every week, if you're going by Tim's or Starbucks or Robin's, pick up a second cup of coffee or a steep tea for somebody out there that's sitting outside the door. And you know that they are going to be sitting outside your door, outside the door of those coffee shops. Today I have a very interesting guest. Her name is Kirsten Warren. And Kirsten, how are you? Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Great. I met you at a poverty reduction, I would say, should I say, class or engagement at the City of Winnipeg. And I was impressed by your outspokenness on the subjects of social injustices and on poverty, which is what we were there for, and other things. And you were the most outspoken person in the room, I think. And I'm automatically drawn to people like you because that's who I am. And so we've been communicating for months now, and I actually put it on Facebook yesterday. Does anybody want to be on my show? And there you were. So I'm so happy that you responded, and we're finally getting to talk on some issues here. How I start out with I know we didn't have time to talk about things beforehand, but this will be, you know, make it easy. What I do for each and every guest, or ask each and every guest to do, is give me a brief bio, if you care to share, on your life and what, you know, what I want to know is what brought you to be such an activist, or such a voice for activism on social justice issues and things like this.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I appreciate it. And I think just I have a diverse background, I would say. I'm born and raised in Winnipeg, in the north end of Winnipeg. Mm-hmm. The heart core of the city, as they say.
Of course, yes.
I have a dad who was very, very active in the community, mm-hmm. whether it was with community centers and stuff like that. He currently does some work for William White Neighborhood Association. It was always his dream that, you know, people, the North End was a place people wanted to go to, mm-hmm. that people wanted to be around. Not that people are afraid and they're talking about arson and they're talking about crime. You know, he was always passionate about
this. Yes.
This is where I live. I don't want people to talk about it like that. How can I, in little ways, change what I can?
Uh-huh.
So I guess that was kind of the fire started,
okay.
community in my life, and it was always just very important to me from then. I was a single mom. I struggled as a teenager with different, you know, behavioral issues and mm-hmm. addictions and stuff like that, but mm-hmm. Then I had my two daughters, and I kind of now work for the government mm-hmm. and went to college and kind of turned my life around in that aspect, as well as I think it's important for people, you know, to speak out, because if people aren't speaking up, then people aren't being outraged at what is happening in
right.
the world, then, and no one speaks up about it, then
right.
we can't change it, right?
You're entirely correct about that. And, you know, many times people coming out of addictions, coming out of homelessness, coming out of serious mental health issues and in recovery cannot do what you and I can do. Because those skills or those the skill of articulation has not come back, or maybe never was there. So I always feel that people like you and I who have a voice and can articulate the issues have a responsibility to do that. And I really thank you for being in and doing this today. How were you able to recover from your early addictions back then, if you don't mind me asking?
I think it was just very important mm-hmm. to basically revamped my life in
Which?
Terms of, I told myself that I cannot be friends with mm-hmm. anyone I was friends with. I changed my phone number. Mm-hmm. I moved to a different area of the city for a small period of time just to totally kind of restart my life.
Which?
But I did that as a young person, so I feel like that might have been a little bit easier to
okay.
then make friends as a young adult.
Yes, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Versus some people are having to restart their lives in midlife, like, and you have no friends, you have nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's so important that during
and in
that
older, like, people look at you differently as well. And,
definitely.
Yeah.
And I think it's very important to also, you know, as you get older, to adapt, like, if society has changed so much and then you're still back there at the point that you are within your trauma, within your addictions, within
yep.
whatever you're dealing with,
yes.
you're still stuck back there. So you have all this catching up with society to do, as well as deal with your mental health, your trauma, and all the things that you're trying to fix within yourself.
Oh,
and it's very hard.
It's multi-leveled and very complex. And you said,
I was young.
Yeah, and you did say the right thing, catching up with society. Which may not mean anything to anybody, but I know exactly what you mean, because it's so hard when you're in a state of recovery to actually get engaged with the social issues and stuff like that. It's almost impossible unless you get a leg up and get some help. Excuse me. I have a frog in my throat today. Not a good thing for a guy on the radio. but we... Also, I was going to comment on, I did a training in Edmonton a couple weeks ago, and I was speaking on mental health and recovery and addictions and recovery and homelessness, and the, I hate to use the word intersectionality because it's overused and sounds like an academic term, And the question was, how did I recover from my mental illness? I wasn't addicted on the street. If I was, I wouldn't be here today. And my answer to that was, again, I think I've spoken on air about this, but I was on the street for 30 months and finally got into a place. And I started volunteering for Mamoe, which is an indigenous organization. And they do a lot of good work in the city and have for years. And they broke the rules and hired this or let this white guy volunteer in their organization. And they had not let anybody do that in 4.5 years. That was not indigenous. I was lucky there. And I was the first non-indigenous person that they actually hired to work in the At-Home Stay Swap program. But what turned my whole mental illness recovery around and sped it up was the fact that I had my focus was on the people at Mumwe, and they got me to take things like EIA advocacy and you know things like that would help there, so I could go and help their participants and their drop-in people, and my focus became on them. And at the same time, I dragged Shar out of Salvation Army, who'd been there for 9.5 years and suffered from schizophrenia and PTSD, and she never spoke for 4 years, and I became a caregiver. And those two things, my focus on the people at Mamoe and Shar, my focus on her recovery, it was really, really tough in the early years because I was trying to recover from homelessness, which took me 6.5 years because of all the trauma. I think it was the focus on both the people at Mamoe and Shar and all their well-being, and it took the focus off me. And 2 years after, or a year and a half after escaping Salvation Army in the second phase of my homeless life, I went straight off my meds and never looked back and never needed them again. And some people say, well, that's not the way to do it, but that's what worked for me. And I think everybody has, it's similar to what you said. You had another focus, and it was your daughter and your kids. And for me, it was somebody else as well. And I don't know if people understand that, the premise of that, but for me, that was it, I think, because I'm no longer worried about myself, type of thing. And I don't know, what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I think that everyone, in terms of your mental health journey, mm-hmm. and whether, you know, choosing to be on medication, not be on medication, I think mental health for each person is so individual.
It is.
That, like, you know, I met someone on the street, and I think I tried to connect you guys, actually, through Facebook. We had talked a couple months ago.
Oh, right.
And basically he said, I don't want to take my medication. It makes me feel not like myself.
Mm-hmm. And well, that's not true. Like that. That can do that.
I'm sitting here. I'm not hurting anybody. I ask for donations or whatever from people.
Yep.
People come, you know. So the thing is like, he's not hurting anybody.
Nope.
But because of him not wanting to conform to what society is mm-hmm. saying he should do.
Mm-hmm.
i.e. be on this medication.
Yes.
Like, he's advocating for himself, which is putting him on the street.
Yes.
Like, so I think it's very important, like, mental health is such a complicated thing in that facet, but definitely, like, mental health is so hard as well because, like you said, shift the focus, right?
Right.
But then when you come back, like, I've noticed now I'm in my, you know, almost 40.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm having to use medications, or I have like anxiety
oh, sure.
and these other issues because of like trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Trauma within my family, right?
Trauma is such a hard thing to get over, if ever. Sometimes it never goes
so
away.
I have all these issues, and being diagnosed with mental health things and whatever, and yeah, it's really hard. to combat that. Like, it's a work in progress every single day for every single person experiencing it. Mm-hmm. Like, and I think that as people, like, we just need to remember, like, when I think of generational trauma, a lot of times in terms of thinking of that, we think the peoples of Manitoba, Indigenous peoples, but there is so many people within the entire, whether it's like my mom's dad came from, she's just a second generation Canadian, right? Like, so her dad immigrated from war, and his trauma got dumped onto her. Then she was not the parent that she could be necessarily, and there was not the mental health help that we're now seeing that mental health is so important, right?
It really
is. It's just coming out now that, like, when I see people being affected, like, whether it's homelessness, addiction, whatever is going on, you know, it's just like, do you think that person wants to be there necessarily? Like, to be, whether they're yelling at themselves, for example, right? Or because they're on a substance. Yes. They don't want to be there being the center of attention. Like, do you think that was their intention? No, they're trying to stop some pain, right? And some
That's exactly it. And so many people simply don't understand. I was at a conference and I said, you know what? There's a lot of escapism that goes into what people do. And people just didn't understand that aspect of things. But unless you've lived it, been on the street, unless you've lived through serious mental health
issues. Or been around people like that.
Yes, you'll not know what that is. And again, I do some work downtown. And every day I'm down there, I see somebody freaking out, being in a period of psychosis.
Correct.
Violent for 20 or 30 seconds, yell and scream at nobody or at somebody. I see this all the time. And, you know, it's for the average person who's not used to this kind of thing, it's really, really hard to understand that kind of behavior.
One, yeah, definitely. But the thing is, if you think about it in terms of that psychosis and what they're going through, like, and then you add, if you think of, like, potentially you add police.
Yes. Well, that's, like, so again, police, there's the X factor.
Police, or then you add, like, so think about it in terms of if it's a police, if it's an authority figure, if it's a doctor, if it's a, you know, like a mental institution.
Yes.
If you're thinking of someone experiencing mental, like, they're not in their right mind, we'll say, right?
Right.
They could be thinking, like, almost like, you know, they're trapped in a mental hospital. They can't escape. And these are the people, like, taking them, dragging them there. Like, that's probably what's going on. Like, we don't know what's going on in any of these people's mind when they're experiencing this. There's no way to tell that.
No.
But to come from a place of authoritative.
Yes.
I'm not saying, like, we don't be concerned about that, but we should be concerned with compassion and kindness and empathy and curiosity.
Entirely. And, you know, I am very, very, very fortunate to be able to spend time training the Winnipeg Police Department and the Winnipeg Fire Paramedic Service. And, you know, it's young kids are great to teach. You know, they are open and they want to learn. And you know, you see the light go on when we're talking, and, you know, the issue goes to maybe veteran police officers from time to time. And when they've been in the position for so long, and everybody's got their jaded ideas about, you know, about the homeless folks and who they are and how to treat them, and it's sad that so many folks out there are mistreated. And but we have a major, major problem today with fentanyl and meth. And you know, every outreach, and right now you can't, the streets are covered right now with the new program we've got with outreach teams, and everybody's carrying a Narcan kit and naloxone. And, you know, a paramedic was on CJOB last week, 2 weeks ago, and he was talking about treating people on the street, and they just finished treating somebody, and he got up and he injected himself right in front of them again, and he said, this is not uncommon. But, you know, my thought on all of this is, yes, we have to save people and give them that shot, but are we not contributing to the addiction by doing that? Because people just say, well, I can just take another shot and get another shot of Narcan and stay alive. And I'm really mixed on that. I know we have to save people's lives. I know we have to give them that. But it just creates such a wheel, a guinea pig, what, hamster wheel, because people just don't get off.
I mean, the way I think about addiction is in terms of, I guess the way I would put it is, if like this was my brother, mm-hmm. or this was my sister,
yes.
or this was somebody that
yep.
I cared about,
yep.
like
entirely.
Or the
yeah.
other part for me is like actual concern if that's not this person's rock bottom.
Yes.
Because that's way past where I would go. And that's not in a judgmental way.
No, I understand.
In a way of like this person, like, for example, I was by City Hall and people are outwardly like smoking a bubble.
Yep.
And I'm like, and it's not like feel sorry, but I'm like, wow, like you have, and again, not from a judgmental space,
nope.
but you don't have any filter.
No, exactly.
You don't want to hide this.
Exactly. And you know
even
what?
And I'm not saying from a legal perspective, like, oh, we should just arrest them and throw them all in jail. Like, I'm not on that camp either,
yeah.
but I'm just saying, like.
And even if they wanted to, they couldn't.
Everywhere.
Even if they wanted to, they couldn't.
And I don't think it would do them anything.
Any good. And let's,
anyhow.
While we're talking about this, is a very controversial 72-hour holding folks at 200 Disraeli. You know, my, you know, and we've had a real spat of deaths lately. Like we had 30 in 3 weeks at one point in time, not that long ago. And I'm sure that number is going to stay there. But, you know, the plan for the province is, you know, put people, the law was 24 hours, but they have to change the law to put people in custody, so to speak, or in a recovery tank per 72 hours. And I think all that does is create a more of a need to go hard after drugs after 72 hours, because you're not going to cure anybody in 72 hours of their addiction. What are your thoughts on that, if you're allowed to speak on that?
I mean, it's definitely a controversial thing. Mm-hmm. Definitely when you're detaining somebody, right?
Yes.
When you're keeping them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just find it concerning when someone is in whatever psychosis or whatever
yes.
they're going through, and they're a threat to others.
Yes.
You know, like, I'm not saying let people go crazy, but people are going to make choices.
Yes.
They are people. They have free will, right?
Mm.
So if they're not bothering me, like I see a drunk person on the bus,
mm-hmm.
I don't bring attention to it. I don't go to the bus driver and be like, hey, man, that guy's
no.
drunk. Like, I just, if he's leaving me alone and he hasn't
yes.
done me any wrong,
that,
I just mind my business and leave
yes,
them alone. They're not hurting anyone.
No, that's right.
You know?
It's the best thing to do.
So I think it's controversial because some of these people are just, like, yes, are they negatively impacting society in terms of
yes.
theft and
yes.
shoplifting and all of these things?
Yes, and they are.
They are, but at the same time, that's a human.
It is.
It's a person.
That's true. And, you know, what's enlightening about this is a doctor within the WHA is suing the province over this. I don't know if you heard that or not, but there's an ongoing lawsuit over this, and I know other agencies across Canada were looking at doing the same thing, but the doctor of Manitoba beat them to it, you know, over the 72 hours, which is kind of cool that a doctor is stepping forward and doing that, because he knows it's a human rights issue, and as a his thought was that it's more dangerous to do this than not.
Well, and I feel like that's just going to make people go more into hiding with their drug use.
Mm-hmm.
So then they're like, if I'm not saying I'm totally pro safe injection.
Of course,
right?
Yeah.
There's clearly issues with that.
Yep.
But if you go ahead and you shoot up and then, sorry for lack of better terms, you use.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah, of course.
You use.
Yep.
You pass out.
Mm-hmm.
And you are no longer breathing. Someone is right there to mm-hmm. be like, okay, you can come back to life.
Yes.
Like, I'm not saying that that's the answer. It's just hey, we're just going to, like you had said earlier, hey, we're just going to Narcan them and start the cycle again. Like,
exactly. And you know, one of the things they said the other day was, okay, then they give them a shot of Narcan, and then people get totally upset with the person
that
give Narcan because they are on a really beautiful high, and you're taking me out of it.
Yes,
I've escaped life for a while, and now you're bringing me back into this drudgery, right?
I mean, I think we have to honor the fact that maybe some people, mm-hmm. like, this is their way of
coping, absolutely.
Of coping, but some people, yeah. maybe it's also their way of, they don't want to be here.
No.
This is how they're choosing to do it.
Yes. Now that's
right? Like, that could be very well for some people that are dealing with addictions will tell you, like, I do not care.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care yes. about my life.
And
like,
you actually see that
every coming
day.
From a place of pain. I'm not saying mm-hmm. that's right. But we also, you know, have to respect people's choice of
yep.
what they want to.
We do.
I just think that we have to find what can be the healthy balance so that we can coexist. Because addiction's not going to go away. You mm-hmm. take stuff off the street, and then, like, there was just a huge drug bust, right?
Yeah, two of
and
them,
then
actually,
all of
yes.
a sudden, people are dropping dead. Why? Because now there's a garbage supply, or
yes.
someone's mixed something with something.
Exactly.
And now it's all toxic drug supply, and people are dropping dead.
And you can't win. And you cannot.
And I'm not saying the police shouldn't do their
no.
job. They shouldn't bust drug dealers.
right.
But, like, it's just all a cycle and a system. So
it
we
is.
Have to find where we can within the system.
Mm-hmm.
Like, where is it broken and what can we do? You know, like homelessness, too. Like,
and
some
we're going to get on homelessness in about 2 minutes, but we have to take a quick station break. So just hang in there, Kirsten. And
yeah.
We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Sounds good.
All right. And we're back, folks. If it's this time on Friday, you're listening to the Hope Alley of No Fixed Address Show with your host, Al. And it is CKUW 95.9 FM, your community radio station right here at the University of Winnipeg. And I have a really interesting person who I've come to really respect for her opinions, and that is Kirsten Warren. And I met her at the City Hall when we were part of a Poverty Action Committee, Poverty Action Group training session. And you were the only voice that really was heard in that session, I think. And just going on talking about poverty, I was part of a minimum income panel discussion this week as well. And what are your thoughts on minimum income? I know Leah Gazan's been a champion of that, and you know, we had experiments in Dauphin that worked really, really well till the government changed and cut it off. And in Ontario, we had minimum income experiments as well. And what did, you know, for me, I have no argument with it. I think it's really, really good to give people their dignity back, right? Because so many people are living on welfare and there's no dignity in that at all. And if you can help people move forward, which the experiment has proven, it's a good thing. What are your thoughts on minimum income?
I mean, I think in terms of in my earlier years mm-hmm. with my first daughter, yes. I was on EIA for a small period of time. Mm-hmm. As a young person, yes. I was in the child welfare system, but I was on an independent living program. So yes. I did live within the, I guess EIA would pay yeah. out and then give a top up for child right. welfare kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I do have a little bit of experience in those systems. And I mean, all I can say is, if people think that the folks living on that kind of money are living high off the hog,
yeah, right.
living the life, like it's not true at all. Like a bedding allowance that hasn't been increased in I don't know how many years.
Exactly.
Of $150 or maybe $170. I don't know what it is now.
And then,
when I got it.
Then only in 7 years. And you could only get a second one in 7 years.
Yeah, 5 or 7 years
it's
or something.
7 years
and I'm like,
now, yeah.
Most of the people living, so I lived at that time in Manitoba housing,
mm-hmm.
dealing with pest control.
Of course.
Issues. Bed bugs,
of
cockroaches.
Of course.
So, I mean, they don't say to you, oh, well, you just had bed bugs and you're fumigated. No, you're going to, put a bed bug cover on and
yes.
you're not getting bit up by bed bugs.
Yep.
Like, that's about it. It's not, oh, here's a new bed. You just had to throw everything
yes.
out. Because, or it's not, okay, you've been struggling with bed bugs at your unit for like 2 years.
Yep.
We'll give you a new bed.
Yep.
You can see all the marks. Like, it's just disgusting. And I don't think there's any dignity in that at all.
There is none.
In terms of, like,
dehumanizing is what it is, actually.
Well, I mean, the other thing is you're dealing with the challenges of sometimes people who are hard to house mm-hmm. being mixed with people who are not hard to house.
Right.
I experienced that. I lived on Yonge Street right by the U of
W, okay.
actually,
yes.
In that blue building.
Yes.
You can probably see it across
yep.
from you if you're on location there.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I lived there for a number of years, and, you know, people would lose their keys, so they would pull the fire alarm
yep.
to get in the building in
yep.
the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And I'm a single mom.
And broken mailboxes.
And
broken mailboxes.
Or like peeing in the, like every,
yes.
Not to sound like a statistic or anything, but every child tax, there would be either pee in the elevator or the stairwell. Like, you know,
right.
and it took me, I think I lived there 5-6 years mm-hmm. and finally, they were installing cameras because I had complained so much about my car being broken into.
Oh.
And I'm like, I have to replace my window. Like, it's
yeah.
not even worth my deductible mm-hmm. each time this happens. Like, and it's off an alleyway, like, you know,
yep.
and they had no security other than when I left, of course.
Yes.
And even that system itself is broken because as soon as I started making a little bit of money, oh, we want to charge you way, way more.
Yes.
And,
you know,
unit that's not
yeah,
livable.
And
Manitoba, not in good condition.
And the Manitoba housing ball has been dropped by governments going back like 50 years or 40 years. I know all about when Manitoba Housing came into being in Manitoba because I put eavesdropping on every single Manitoba Housing unit and in the province. But they've let the units go so badly, and, you know, some of them had to be just given up and destroyed. Instead of using them for low-income housing, you know, Lake 185 Smith, for example, it went to market housing to Essex or somebody, and they spent $16 million fixing it up and $16 million paying for it. That's $32 million, and they took it and are making a profit on it. But Manitoba Housing would not keep housing in the shape that people could live in. And, you know, I mean, sure, they had fire damage and all kind of water damage, all kinds of stuff. But if Manitoba Housing had looked after it in the first place, you know, I think, they let so many units go that are uninhabitable. And that's a crime, I think, because today when we don't have enough housing, you know, we could use all those things.
Well, yes, definitely. And I think it's also important to honor people's wish to be housed or not. To be housed.
Entirely.
Like, if they're, I have come up with this idea, and I'm not sure if I've shared it with you, but I've shared it with others. I'm like, why don't we make a tent city?
Mm-hmm. Well, of course.
You got the rules
and
for tent city.
Yes.
This is what you don't do.
I buy into the designated camps. Halifax has designated camps, and they work great. My good friend and counselor, Cindy Gilroy, who we sometimes have words, went to Halifax and came back with a report on designated camps. And, it was a buzz about it. And, you know what? If we cannot house these people in decent housing, let's work with them and give them a respectable, living environment where they are. And Halifax is exactly that. The camps and the parks are clean, and they work with the city to maintain.
And definitely. And you could even, in a way of dignity and pride, mm-hmm. say, you know what, we'll hire you for minimum wage.
They do that
clean up for 2-3 hours
yes,
a day.
They do that in
and
Halifax.
Rotate the duties among the people
yes.
so they can all get a little bit of money.
Yep.
Like almost like its own little co-op,
they do that in Halifax. And the problem is that, as you may remember, about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, the report came down. No, we can't do this. It costs too much money for a few hundred thousand a year. Are you joking? You know, sometimes, again, people have political lives. So their political lives are 4 years. And so they don't want to spend this money on this, but maybe promote camps. But sometimes you got to think out of the box and do something like this.
This is the thing which I believe is why, like, people have rights.
Yes.
So if they want to be in a tent,
mm-hmm. they have the right to do that.
Designated place that they could, like, so for example, if I go and I pay mm-hmm. for Birds Hill,
yep.
I can go camp. What? How is it any
yes,
different than
yes,
that?
Yes, you
if
can.
You pay a nominal fee
yep.
through, say EIA.
And guess
a
what?
A lot of the recipients, a lot of unhoused mm-hmm. people may be on EIA. Or if you're not on EIA, we'll give you an even lower rate.
Yes, and guess
whether
what?
And it doesn't matter where the money comes from.
Yeah, and, I lost my train of thought. You know, it does work, and it can work. To actually destroy a camp goes against Bill C-93 in our Constitution put in there in 2019. It says everybody's got a right to housing, and that right to housing includes tents, right? And so everybody's got a right to that. And I worked for the city of Abbotsford and the homeless camp encampment there, and they were called the drug war survivors. And the city of Abbotsford said, you can park in our camp in our parks, but you got to remove your tent every morning and bring it back at night. So they went to the BC, they went to court over it, and it went all the way up to the BC Supreme Court. And the BC Supreme Court ruled in their favor and gave them $650,000. And it obviously created a lot of tension between the city and the camps. My job, I went in there in Abbotsford about four times and worked as a liaison, I guess, in between the two. But our governments have to be very, very careful that they're not being sued all to heck over this kind of stuff. But designated camps, as you brought up, they do work. I've seen it firsthand in Halifax. And it just, but you can't say it, but I can say it, is that our city has a problem interacting with the folks in the camps directly. I don't think that it's, and other than the policy enforcement officers that are out there now, right, and trying to get people not to camp in 10 different areas or 10 specific types of places in the city, which makes camping, makes camps illegal. It makes homelessness illegal. And whose fault is that? That's our fault. You know, but, yo, I totally agree with you, and I've seen it work. And I appreciate you bringing that up.
I just think on governmental levels, they look for so much red tape to say no instead of just, okay, let's find an, like, it could be an interim solution or it could be an experiment of 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just find a plot of land.
Yep.
Say these boundaries are.
Mm-hmm.
Put in a couple water taps like you have at Birds Hill Park.
And washrooms and dumpsters.
Put dumpsters and erect one bathroom like the one on Main Street in front of Salvation Army.
Yes.
And cool.
And you know, a couple of years ago, there was an encampment at 180 Higgins on that big empty lot there. And, and the campers asked for a dumpster so they could keep the place clean. But guess what? The city said no. And so this is the kind of thinking we have at times that is so detrimental to progress. And it just showed so little respect for folks out there. But they're asking, give us a dumpster so we can keep this place clean. And the city wouldn't do it. So,
I mean, I think it's more like, I can't speak for anybody else.
No, of course
I don't know if it's fear or like what it is, but I just don't understand. Like, go talk to a person.
Yes.
When I was younger, when my daughter was very small, I worked for the Urban Green Team for the Mosaic Market Biz.
Right.
Which the boundaries are like Sutherland in Maine to like Mountain in Maine.
Yes.
Is the Mosaic Market Biz. So within doing that, you know, like, I see the same people every morning. They're packing up their stuff and they're doing their thing, or they're sitting. Like, so it would be a joke sometimes. They'd be like, oh, can you sweep my soup? Like, people are so, like, down to earth. If you just talk to them like a person.
Entirely.
They're humans who have the same problems.
And they're in crisis, maybe. Right. And, you know, I've been a trainer and a neighborhood coordinator for every single one of our homeless street census or point in time counts. And you know, when people go, well, I send, you know, I'm in a downtown in the core area, and I send them about 160 people per shift, and you know, the thing, it's really, really good that people come back and they're so pleasantly surprised and they want to go back again and engage again. And I'm so happy that that's the case. But my question always is, why are you so surprised? Why are you so happy? Why are you so surprised that these people are nice?
Exactly. You know, they're just people.
They're just people like you and I are. And then I say, I was one of those people, folks. You know, don't judge a book by its cover. And I say that so many times. Hey, look at me. You know, I was one of those. And and I really appreciate the fact that people, that for me, the byproduct or the most important aspect of the point in time count, never mind the numbers that we have to give to the federal government for funding and all that, is the fact that people are introduced to homeless folks and they get a whole different perspective on who people are that are out on the street. And I think that's one of the great keys to the point in time count. We're just almost running out of our time here. Is there something that you'd like to leave with our listeners out there that's a goal of yours, a pet peeve of yours, or a solution that you think that you'd like to see?
I think just people should be more engaged in the community, even if downtown isn't your community, the core isn't your community.
Right.
Be engaged with people, you know, don't judge them. And I think the way I live and lead my life is that we're all one paycheck away from experiencing homelessness.
Hey, I made $200,000 a year. I ended up on the street.
Right. So it can happen to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone can experience addiction. You could be the best parent in the world and your child tries drugs with their friend and they're addicted to drugs. Like, it's not discriminative.
Yep.
You know, addictions, experiencing homelessness, all those things don't discriminate because you're black, white,
no,
your income level,
you're
so. Anything. It can happen to any of us. And I think it's just, you know, be compassionate to mm-hmm. others. Come from a place of love and kindness. Don't come from being scared and not knowing and, oh, I need to get away from
yes.
that person. They're acting crazy.
Yes.
Like, maybe just say, hey, are you okay?
Yes. Thank you so much for that. I really appreciate that. You know, I've been on Hal Anderson's show many, many times, and I got on a show about 3 weeks ago over the rash of deaths we had, right? And because he was going to talk about the one death in the person in the storage unit at MMF, and I said, "What?" I said, "One person? Are you joking?" At that point, we had 30 deaths in 3 weeks. I said, "Hal, wake up." You know, and so mm-hmm. after Al's on the show, what I appreciate about Hal having me on the show, I get to talk for 10 or 11 minutes, which, you know, hardly any other people do. And so what happened was the comments and texts. He said, oh, my goodness, I'm getting a lot of texts on this. And so I said, Hal, let me know what your what the texts were about and which way people were leaning. And so he put it on Facebook because we're on Facebook. And I must have had, you might have seen that, but must have had like 80, 90 comments and about, oh, it's their fault. It's, you know, they're doing it to themselves and this kind of stuff, right? And I just find it so, not frustrating, but so helpless when people have this much judgment against folks and do not understand what they're talking about.
Definitely. It's sad, you know,
it
because
is.
they're just a human being. They're just a person.
They are.
And like, they're probably mm-hmm. not feeling loved or safe
yeah.
or
and, you know,
whatever the thing is that they're feeling that you're,
and,
you know.
And, you know, the whole thing is, too, is what helped me escape was I had a previous life, right? I had a life of making $200,000 a year and all that kind of stuff. I had a Mercedes. I had something to aspire to, whereas so many people come down from reserves and land on Main Street hoping for something better, and it gets worse.
Well, and there's nothing better on Main Street.
And there's nothing better on Main Street, and people die here, and the drugs are here. And so I had a leg up because I had at least something to aspire to, and that kept me going. But I feel so sorry for folks that and then they turn to drugs if they're not already, and it's so tough. And I just, again, like you, I plead for people just to try to understand just a little bit of the dire straits that people are in, and the darkness that follows people around who are on the streets.
Definitely. Most of those people, it's like you just want to give them that hug yeah. that tells
That's
them
exactly
that
it.
They matter and they're loved, and that you just wish that whatever they're going through mm-hmm. could be away
yes.
and gone so that they could feel better.
Yeah, Kirsten, I really want to thank you for coming on, and we have to have that coffee soon.
But, amazing. We definitely do.
And folks, we're going to be back next week with a really entertaining person who used to work for my MP, Leah Gazan, who's now neighborhood coordinator for the Main Street Area Action Plan, Jennifer Black. And you'll find her as interesting as Kirsten. But Kirsten, I really appreciate you coming on and giving us your perspective on things, especially from where you are right now with the city and all.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to, you know, be a voice and
yeah.
have my voice out there. And
keep commenting on Facebook.
Definitely, 100%.
Take care.
All right. Thank you so much, Al.
You bet.
Have a wonderful day.
You too. Thanks. And folks, come on back next week. Again, we're going to have a great show. Again, it's kind of a miserable day out there. It's not cold. It's around 16, going 18. But, again, buy a coffee, buy a steep tea. Today, it's one of those days where, you know, when you get warm days, buy water. Lots of water that needs to be handed out. And water's cheap. And just buy a 24 or something and hand it out on the weekend. But anyway, come back next week. And take care.
to KTW 95.9 FM.
Winnipeg.
Tune in. Yeah. What's happening?
And who's happening?
What's happening? Ooh.
Listener-driven, locally focused. You're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.